It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport, don't worry. This is the Ticket. We're just kicking it around. Now, here's two guys who still have their moms drive them to practice, Andy Swift and Peter Welpton.
Hi-de-ho, P1s, and welcome to another thankfully relieving World Cup qualifying edition of the Kick Around. We will be back this Saturday live from 2 to 4 on the Ticket. Hi, it's me, Peter, and I am joined by my soccer-talking BFF and a man who's had a really good soccer day, the amazing Andy Swift. Hey, Andy.
Peter, how are you?
Man.
In a much different place than we thought we'd be an hour or so ago,
not even
right?
An hour ago. Yeah, we're recording this literally minutes after USA 4, Honduras 1, and it was the Ricardo Pepi show. And to join us, we have our special guest, and I'm glad he's here, because if anybody knows anything about Ricardo Pepi, it's the man that actually gave him the L-Train nickname to begin with, Buzz Carrick from ThirdDegree.net. Hello, Buzzard.
Hello, Peter. Yeah, I must say that today was a pretty emotionally uplifting day for me, even from before the kickoff. Just thinking back to like the first time I ever saw Pepi, you know, when he was when he first came into the U17 team, and to today, what a journey it's been. And all credit to him. It's all him. I had nothing to do with it other than giving him a clever nickname.
Well, so. I hope you sell so many effing T-shirts you pay your mortgage for a month.
Well, I got to make one with the 14 on it now.
All right. Let's see, because we always need a big, high-profile soccer media guy all the way from ESPN and the West Coast, Jeff Carlisle. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to the Kick Around.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the invite.
This is a good one to be on, right? We're all in a good mood. I was going to be kind of upset and disappointed for you if we were all bummed out and near suicidal, and this was your debut on the Kick Around pod. That would have sucked.
It would have, but hey, it's all good now. We can bask a little bit in the afterglow of this immense win by the U.S. I mean, obviously we'll get into it, but I've never seen a turnaround like that ever from a U.S. team.
Okay, so, well, you're already started. Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I think after 45 minutes, the collective attitude about the entire thing was, this is all crap. Everything's crap. Everything's always going to be crap. U.S. is never going to win anything ever again. We may never even make a World Cup we're automatically qualified for in 2026. We're so bad. Talk about the turnaround and how you feel about it in the aftermath of 4-1 USA.
I mean, I guess if you're going to talk about the turnaround, you got to talk about what happened before.
Sure.
I mean, in this lineup, I mean, not even so much the formation, but the way players were positioned. I mean, Tyler Adams at right back, you know, James Sands in midfield, you know, Josh Sargent on the wing. I mean, it just, so much about this seemed wrong, and it showed on the field. I mean, so many U.S. attacks died with Josh Sargent, you know, just short passes, you know, underhitting passes, missing on passes. And, you know, I mean, James Sands, he really looked like a boy among men. I mean, he was just getting overpowered and couldn't stay on his feet.
Now.
And, but, you know, as much as Greg Berhalter deserves criticism for that lineup and that formation, he made some changes at halftime that really turned the game around. You know, he brought on Anthony Robinson, who's had a fantastic window, it has to be said. You know, he brought on, you know, Sebastian Legette and Brendan Aaronson, and lo and behold, I mean, everything just turned around quickly, and, you know, 4 second half goals. I mean, really incredible. And, you know, at halftime, you're looking at a 2-point window.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And a team that's just in so much trouble and looking up at so many other teams in the octagonal. And now they got 5 points. And, you know, it's just amazing the roller coaster ride of emotions that
is
taking place.
Right. Yeah. Hey, Buzz, yeah. Let's talk about Buzz, the lineup, because, man, I certainly felt like, I realized that the first two games didn't go the way Greg wanted them, but that lineup and the way that he put players in certain places just felt like he was throwing axes blindfolded.
Yeah, listen, we talked here in Dallas a lot about this 3-4-3 formation when FC Dallas tried to do it, right? And we talked all the time about, when you play three-man back line, if you sit back, it becomes a five-man back line. So effectively, you were looking at a 5-2-3. It's the same formation, tactics are fluid. We talk about it all the time. But the problem is that when you play that three-man front line, and this is what we discovered in Dallas earlier this year, those two wings, if the two guys that are ostensibly the wings keep playing as wings, then you abandon the midfield completely. And in this case, because the wing backs also sat back, you were left with just two guys in the midfield. Well, you just get overrun. The entire first half, they were overrun through the central midfield. And it was clear from the very get-go that that was going to be a problem. Any of us that have seen this formation played exclusively figured that probably on the road it was going to happen like this the minute we saw that that's how it was laid out. And it almost doesn't matter which people you put in different situations. Depending on, you could put a yell on it right back. If his instructions are to sit back and be a five-man back line and the wings are supposed to stay high, you're going to get crushed in the midfield. It doesn't matter who the personnel is. So, you know, there was an adjustment at halftime as it was just been talked about extensively. They fixed the formation. They fixed that problem. So adjustment, good. Initial plan, bad.
Andy, you're our CONCACAF expert. You've actually been to this stadium. What is it about that field? It looks like it's a sponge. The Honduran players clearly know how to play on it, but the field itself looked like it was a problem for the United. Like, people couldn't keep their feet and had trouble, you know, cutting and turning. Is the field as weird in person as it looks like on television?
Well, I think it was just wet today. It rained all day. Probably didn't have enough time to completely drain. It was humid. So that lends to it continuing to stay wet. And, you know, Honduras is used to playing on that field. There's a reason why they go there instead of playing in Tegucigalpa, that they go to that particular stadium because it's a little bit stickier, a little bit more humid. And I think that helps them. So, but yeah, it rained all day long and that probably didn't help the conditions.
Yeah, Andy, I know your Canada got a big, big win today themselves. But I do wonder when you saw that he was going to play Tyler Adams as a right back, we've talked about this on the show and we've seen coaches do this in the past. I mean, you see Pep Guardiola even make weird coaching decisions in big games. What do you think it is that Greg is going through Greg's mind to stick so many guys that have never played in a World Cup qualifier in a game of this level of importance, and some of them even out of position? That just seems so weird to me.
Yeah, I was trying to, you know, Greg's got this reputation of overthinking things, right? So it's like, okay, if you're overthinking things, what are you overthinking with that move? Is it because he's tired and he just didn't feel like he could have the same presence he usually does being the six? But, you know, you got to run where he was playing also. And it, you know, it showed that he was a little bit tired legged, and we also missed his presence in the middle. So why do it? I for me, the story of the game, I mean, you can talk about the tactics and the poor formation or the poor choice of starters, I guess, and then the tactical change that led to the better second half. But after watching that first half and during that first half, I was thinking to myself, I don't remember the last time the U.S. looked so bad.
Yeah.
In one half of play. And I don't know how many of you guys thought the same thing. To then play a second half where they scored four goals.
On the
when
road.
Was the last time they scored four goals in one half? I mean, the 180, you know, one thing is to kind of change the tactics and the team changes personality a little bit and adapts and turns things around. But This turnaround was something that I haven't seen before.
Yeah. By the way, the last time the United States had scored more than one goal in a game was seven matches ago against Martinique, a country not even recognized by FIFA. So at halftime, just getting one goal and leaving with a tie felt like that would have been a win. Jeff, one of the big things that was going on was the lack of connection between Sargent and Pulisic and Pepe, and even trying to advance the ball from midfield forward. It just was lost passes left and right, and that seemed kind of obvious considering how little these guys have played together.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, I think as Buzz alluded to, that there was no connection, and there was just this huge gap. I mean, you had Sargent kind of drifting upfield, you know, he wasn't kind of coming back very much. I mean, obviously you want Pulisic to stay, you know, somewhat forward. You don't want him getting dragged back as well. And I mean, those three guys were basically on an island. But even when they did get the ball, I think Sargent in particular, just didn't look like he knew what to do with it. He didn't, you know, look like he wanted to take anybody on. Not that that's his game, but, you know, his alternative was just to simply pass it back to a guy who was like 3 yards away from him. And they just never really looked threatening outside of that one chance that Pepe had in the first half, I think. And so it's just mind-boggling, I think, again, to go with that alignment. And I say James Sands really looked overwhelmed, and it doesn't look athletic enough at this level in the center of midfield. I remember during the Gold Cup when I saw, you know, I said on Twitter that James Sands is a center back for me. Mm-hmm. And all the NYCFC fans started, you know, lighting me up saying, oh, well, you've never seen him, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he anticipates in midfield. And I mean, I saw him losing physical challenges in the Gold Cup. And I remember thinking, how is that going to get any better if he's in the center of midfield and he's having to chase guys more? So, you know, I think Berhalter got away with one on that. You know, obviously it was a learning experience for Sands, but Tyler Adams back in the center of midfield, please. And everything else kind of cascades from there. I do want to make one comment. You were talking about the goals, and my old ESPN colleague, Paul Carr, said it was the first time the U.S. has scored 4 second-half goals in a final round qualifier.
Wow. So, ever. That's
yeah,
pretty. That's,
yeah. That's, it that's, was a... It was the second World Cup qualifying win after trailing at halftime, and the third win in an away World Cup qualifier after conceding first. So
the good old Paul Carr.
Some pretty stunning numbers. Yeah.
Hey Buzz, when you know, one of the things I was worried about with Pepe in this game was what happens if it doesn't go well for Ricardo, and, you know, now he's got a bit of a funk stuck to him, and what does that mean for an 18-year-old trying to figure out playing at a national level? And while it went well for Pepe, and we'll talk about that in a second, the reality is that's the kind of thing that has now happened to Sands and even Bello to a certain degree, who really just had really poor showings overall and were really, as Jeff said, overwhelmed by the game.
Well, if it had gone bad for Pepe, the answer would have been nothing. Because, you know, I've told you guys before, and you probably have met him enough to know this, the kid is blessed, as I jokingly say, like Nuke Lush from Bull Durham, he's blessed with a complete lack of any self-doubt. So if it had gone poorly for him, he would have just shrugged it off, just like he's shrugged off every other time he maybe hasn't scored a goal or he hasn't gotten the opportunity that he expected. The kid just plows right through the wall, just like he always does, and he comes out the other end, just like he always does. I mean, it's every single time now that he's ever had any adversity put in front of himself, he plows through it like mm-hmm. it's not even there. So that would have been the answer. If it had gone poorly, the stink wouldn't have stuck to Pepe, because it's like he's an 18-year-old kid in his first ever game. The stink would have been, oh, why did you pick an 18-year-old kid in his first ever game in a qualifier? Or the stink would have been on John Brooks, who had two of the worst games we've seen in a decade as a center back. You know, that kind of thing. And by the way, I'm sure the reason he put Adams at right back is the same answer we talked about last time we did this podcast, Peter, which was that there are no two-way outside backs on this roster. Everybody that was an outside back is a flying attacking outside back. And if you needed to go on the road and have a little defense, that's probably why he put Adams out there, who plays that position quite a bit with his pro team.
Well, go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Peter.
No, go ahead.
Before we stop talking about the first half, and the choices that Berhalter made, the way he started the game. Is he training with those guys in those positions? I mean, there's not a lot of time to get that together and get it all sorted out in between games when you're playing 3 and 7. And so I question whether they even had trained that way for very long. And was he seriously thinking it was going to work? Because I think there was a lot of self-doubt when we saw the lineup, right? This is not going to work, is what a lot of people were saying. Independent of Pepe starting at the 9, I didn't have an issue with that. I think it was everything else.
Yeah, Jeff, you actually were with the team prior up until this game here. Did you have a chance to see anything like this in training or get a sense that this was a likely formation he was going to roll with?
No, I mean, training is closed. You know, there have been a couple times where, you know, during the week that I was gone, where, you know, you got to see them, you know, maybe in the stadium, but it, you know, after the first 15 minutes, which is basically a warm up, you know, they kicked the media out and we're not allowed to see anything. But I think it's a fair topic to bring up, because I think Berhalter has spoken about how quick the turnaround is and how compressed the schedule is, because, you know, they all arrive on a Sunday, and maybe they get, you know, a couple games or a couple practices in, but I mean, you guys are also arriving at different times. I mean, you know, if they play it on a Sunday, they're not getting there till Monday. And so I think the safe answer to say is that they haven't had much time to train, you know, a three in the back formation or anything like that. I mean, now granted, some of the guys that played in the Gold Cup will have been trained in that, but this whole group together, no. I mean, I can't see how they had any extended time on the practice field to kind of work out the kinks.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at Twitter, and I've already seen that he has a post-game quote saying he got it wrong in the first half and he needed to make changes. The other thing that is now, this is so amazing, I can't believe I'm seeing this happen on Twitter. Fabrizio Romano, the world-famous leaker of all things transfers and player sales, replied to an FC Dallas post with, "Here we go, smiley face USA flag." I don't know what that, if that doesn't, I don't know if that doesn't tickle you guys as much as it does me, or just the amazement that Fabrizio Romano's talking about Ricardo Pepi on Twitter already. That just blows my mind, considering that I was watching this kid play for the under-19s what seems like 3 weeks ago, which is,
well, it just tells you that you better get your FC Dallas number 9 scouting list ready for this winter.
Yeah.
Think about what he did, though. I mean, especially those of us that live in Dallas, we're kind of caught up that it was Pepi and he's our boy and he's 18 and he plays on the team and we've been rooting for him to get this start and all that. But he started for the team when they needed the 3 points. I mean, this was as close as you can get to a must win this early in the qualifying tournament, right? Mm-hmm. And he scored the game winner, but he had a hat trick of assists.
Yeah, he was involved in all 4 goals. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it really is incredible.
It is. And I think one of the more impressive parts is that we all talk about how his weakness in his game is the hold-up play. And he certainly didn't have a great game holding the ball up, but on that first goal, he did a fantastic job to hold it up, play it off to Pulisic, and then got in the mix on the rebound for Robinson to finish it. And I, you know, it was a fantastic performance from the kid. It's unbelievable. And you're right, Buzz. I just hope we get to at least finish watching this season with him, because I think the Turkish window is still open.
I imagine if this guy had picked Mexico. I mean, it's just, imagine not so much where Mexico would be, but where the U.S. would be. And it just, I mean, I don't want to ever see Josh Sargent again. I really don't. I know that this is post game, and you're often, and I'm as guilty of it as anyone in terms of being a prisoner of the moment. But, you know, Ricardo Pepi has showed me more in 2 games than Josh Sargent has showed me in 20 for the national team, and so it blows me away.
I think we have to, you mentioned him playing for the Mexican national team. We have to give the federation a little bit of credit here, because we kind of dumped on the federation when they lost a couple of players to the Mexican national team. Why didn't they react fast enough? And why didn't they coddle those guys and bring them over to the U.S.? But they did that with Pepi. And I think they either saw, you know, how important he could be to the team, or they learned from their past mistakes, both. And credit to Buzz, who called it, who said he should start this game just to get him cap-tied more than anything. Right, Buzz? I mean, that was your feeling.
Well, but no, man, it was a combination of his mentality and the cap tie thing. You know, the fact that he always rises to the occasion.
Yeah. And, you know, you brought that up on the last podcast. But I think we have to give the Federation credit for moving quickly this time with him. And it paid off.
Boy, did it ever. Wow. Buzz, one of the things I'm interested in hearing you talk about tactically is the changes that Berhalter did make, because even with the formation change and the personnel change, he still left Tyler Adams out on the right as a right fullback, which I found very confusing, and why he didn't make the change with Yedlin and put him back in the middle sooner. But what was the impact of that change, and why did it so dramatically flip the game from something so bad bad to so good?
Well, it ended the overrun in the midfield. If you remember why we discussed why myself and Tyler last podcast too, and probably a lot of other people thought they would go to three at the back, is they had this overabundance of center backs on the roster. We thought it must be for a reason tactically that they decided it was something in their holster. And the reason why you would do it is because you bring on those wing backs and they overload the midfield. And if you play 3-5-2, then your number 10 is back in there too, also overloading the midfield. And that's what you want to control against Honduras, is the midfield. So when he made the adaptation to go back to the 4-3-3, you know, Berhalter system, the outside backs don't sit deep. They sit a little bit higher, almost up with the level of midfield, and you're back to the three-man basic midfield. And by dropping out Sargent, you end up with basically, you know, more of the kind of 4-3-3 that you're used to, which is when you have, you know, Roldans and your guys that we talked about this too on the last podcast, the false wings that they are so abundant on this team, who all check in and play tight and play underneath a little bit. So all of a sudden you went from effectively two guys in the midfield to basically like six guys in the midfield, and you took control of the middle of the park and took control of the game. And then you can able to counterattack from that mid-block position and get forward. And that's where you saw the effective goals being scored, was on these mini breaks coming out of the middle part of the pitch. So that was the big change.
Jeff, when you're hanging out with the national team, and I don't know what access you do or don't have with them, but do you have any sense about how the guys get along as a crew with Berhalter? Because, you know, there's, you know, in the run up to this game, man, the pitchforks and torches were out for Greg once again. And I would love to have some of your insight as to what you think the collective vibe is about the team, maybe pre-Weston, and we can talk about the Weston stuff later on.
Well, I think one of the big takeaways coming out of the Nations League win was, you know, how it was a real affirmation of Berhalter's leadership. You know, you saw some of the reaction on the goals, and even Weston McKennie sprinting, you know, 50, 60 yards, you know, to give Berhalter a hug. And, you know, I mean, I've heard that you have to take that with a grain of salt. And like you said, we'll get into the McKennie stuff a little bit later. But, you know, it did very much feel like a team that was playing hard for its coach. And playing hard for themselves. I mean, I think it's never entirely one or the other. I think it's always a mix. And so, you know, and when things go wrong, you know, obviously I think people are going to, and hey, I'm guilty of this myself. You know, people are going to overanalyze, you know, read too much into body language, too much into the way things react. But, you know, I think the relationship between the players and the coach is pretty solid. And, you know, I'm not going to say that it's, you know, it's run through a brick wall type stuff, you know, when it comes to Berhalter. You know, he isn't the most charismatic guy, you know, he's not, you know, kind of this fire and brimstone leader, but, you know, I'd say it's pretty solid. And, you know, I think, you know, the Nations League was instructive, but only to a point. I think this last win is probably more instructive, because this team went out there and resurrected a situation that was looking pretty dire. And, you know, you think about, man, 2 points out of three games. That's really what this team was looking at halftime. And then, okay, 3 points, you know, like others have said, you know, you'll take that. And then to get, you know, the full 3 points in the night and end up with 5 in this window, you know, I think that does speak well of the relationship. I'd say it's solid. It's not like over the top, you know, hey, we do anything for this guy. But I think it's a stable relationship, especially after tonight's win.
All right, Jeff, but if they had lost this game tonight, and you know, there's various different versions of how you lose. You know, you lose because of a bad ref call, or you get blown out, or it's a total disaster. It's just a, you know, one of those. How solid is Berhalter's position within the Federation if that scenario had played out?
I mean, I think it's pretty solid for a couple reasons. I think one, I think the compressed schedule makes it harder to change coaches midstream. I mean, these guys are going to be back together in 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and or 4 weeks tops. And so, you know, if you're the U.S. Soccer Federation, are you really going to throw everything aside that Berhalter has tried to build in his, you know, during his time in the job, and go with someone else and start completely over?
Right.
I mean, right. Really, the only way that you could do that is after the November window, where you've got a little bit of time before, you know, the games in January. So it's, but then you also look at the leadership, and I mean, Ernie Stewart is not a guy to make knee-jerk reactions. I mean, we saw that in Philadelphia, and usually I think that's good. I mean, it allows for a little bit more continuity and a little bit more stability. So I think even if they had lost this game tonight, I do not think that Ernie Stewart was going to pull the trigger, and I don't think Cindy Parlow Cohn would do that either. I don't think she's, yes, she might be the USSF president, but, you know, just in terms of how she came into the job, I mean, and they hire these sporting directors on both the men's and women's side for a reason. And yeah. It's to kind of let them do their job and hire the people that they think are going to create an environment of success, you know, whether it's the women's national team or the men. So, you know, I think the pressure is certainly off now, that the talk of firing Berhalter will abate for a little bit before the next crisis, and God knows it's qualifying, so there's going to be another one that gets encountered. But I would have been shocked if in light of a loss tonight, if the USSF would have taken that step.
Yeah. All right. Now, Andy, I'm sitting here looking at the CONCACAF table at this point, and I do wonder, and any of you guys can reply to this, going into this whole thing, if we found out we'd be tied for second behind Mexico, would everybody have taken that? Because what I think a lot of people haven't talked about, the fact is, scoring four goals got them to leap over Panama on goal differential, because now they're actually in third in the standings with all the outburst of goal scoring. We would have been happy with that at this point, right, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I know you would have been, because your team's in second.
But I'm talking about the U.S. specifically, in second place after three matches.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? You draw on the road, you win at home, but they got their one win at home and two draw result at the end of the day, right? I mean, we would have been happy with 5 points if the win would have been at home and two draws on the road, right?
So sure, yeah.
And we're finding out that Canada's maybe a little bit better than we thought. Buzz was right. Buzz, kudos to you. I saw today what you were talking about. They looked really good
without Davies.
Alphonso Davies.
Would you have been happy? Would you have been happy with this position at the end of three games, Buzz?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, as Andy said, it didn't happen the way you script it, but that's the point total for win at home, tie on the road. So there's nothing wrong with that at all. And there's 11 games left. I mean, that's a ton of games left.
Boy,
so,
there is.
Yeah, I mean, now that we feel good about ourselves and our country, there's a lot to play for still, a ton to play for. So it's like, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves that they're on five when you've got 11 more games to play.
Jeff, when you were with the team, did you, before the whole sequence, even before the El Salvador game, what was the overriding sense of what they expected out of these three games?
There was a lot of talk about 9 points. I mean, granted, players are always going to be confident. You know, they're gonna believe that you know they can win every game. But you know, it just seemed a little bit over the top. Because as you know, I mean, I can remember 3-game losing streaks for the U.S. in qualifying, and I think that was in the you know, the 2002 cycle. And you know, they obviously still made it, but. You know, there was some naivete as well. I mean, I think there wasn't, and some of the players that I have talked to who hadn't experienced this before were shocked at like how players were coming into tackles and how aggressive they were. And these are guys with quite a bit of European pedigree. And so I think there was a lack of understanding about what these games are like, about, you know, the approach that opponents are going to take, the conditions, and all the things that we talk about. And it seems like, man, they should have this figured out by now, but I think there is something to be said in terms of, you know, until you actually experience it, you don't really have an appreciation for what these games are like.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the things that I'm just starting to realize is, because this is all happening so quickly, is the story of the game is this 18-year-old kid that plays for my club, and what we really haven't even talked about at all is Christian Pulisic, who didn't not have a good game by his standard. And kind of getting back to what you just said, if there's one player that seems to be most affected by how play is allowed in CONCACAF, it's Christian, who was really frustrated and has been frustrated over these three games. And the minute I watched him so determinedly take that ball into that lion's den of Minor Figueroa, who's got a knee that's older than Christian Pulisic, and take it, I was really worried he was going to get hurt, and it clearly he did. But Buzz, do you think that maybe he's the one that's really been most affected by the rough play of CONCACAF?
Oh yeah, no, unquestionably. And the first half, we saw a lot again of the watch Christian try and dribble everybody effect, where the rest of the team is just standing around, sort of waiting for him to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when you have a player of his stature in a team, you know, of any kind, there's always going to be a certain amount of that. I mean, we've talked about that with Messi for years, that the rest of the Argentine team just stands around waiting for him to do something. They're better at it now, which is probably why they've all of a sudden done really well. But when you have a young team like this, and there was all this talk all the time about how young this team was and the youngest in this and the youngest in that. I remember when I was a young man back in the 70s. Oh, my God. My parents would always say things like, well, we've tried to tell you, but I guess you're just going to have to learn by doing, you know. And that's kind of what I felt like when I watched this game and the other game down in El Salvador in particular. They seem really surprised by the atmosphere and by the fact that the referee is calling nothing for them and everything for the home team. And, you know, Tyler Adams is throwing his arms in the air. And I'm like, Tyler, it's minute 70. You should have figured this out. I'm sure the coach has told you, and you obviously didn't believe him. And now we're 10 minutes into the game, and you should have figured it out. And now we're 70 minutes into the game, and you still haven't figured it out. You're not going to get the calls today. And so for a guy like Pulisic, who is not a big, gigantic, robust guy, he's a little bit on the thin side, so he's going to get hit and knocked and slashed and smashed, and you saw it take a toll as the game went on. And eventually they had to take him out of the game. So, of course, Pulisic's going to get affected more than anybody else, particularly in the first half when everyone was just watching him dribble.
So what was not on the field during the comeback after it was 1-1, those last three goals, that period of time when they scored those three goals and really turned the game around, what was missing?
Well, for me...
Not tactically. What was missing was Pulisic, McKennie, Dest, and Reyna.
Yeah,
and those were the guys, you know, with Adams, that were really going to take this team to the next level, right? And it was done tonight without four of those guys. And that's pretty incredible when you think about it. We would have never thought, like, if before this series of three games in 7 days started, we were told those four guys weren't going to play that last game, and what were our chances of winning that game 4-1?
Especially if you're already down 1-0 at halftime.
Yes.
Yeah, right. That is incredible. And in fact, you know, I asked this question in the last episode about how many times those four guys have played together for the national team, and the beautiful mind of John Arnold actually looked this up. In the 38 games Berhalter has been the manager of the national team, he has only had those four guys available in the same game once, and that was the win over Mexico earlier this year. And I later realized, and this was again Jeff Paul Carr that brought this up, they didn't even all play in that game at the same time, because I believe Gio Reyna subbed out when Tyler Adams came on. In the 38 games Berhalter's been manager of this club, he's never been able to play Christian Pulisic, Gio Reyna, Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie in the same game. And I think that is really, I mean, you can't always expect that to happen, but for everybody that has this really good feeling about how good this team potentially can be, the fact that he's never been able to put his four best players on the field at the same time is bizarro in my mind.
I just want to make sure you give credit to John Leonard and not John Arnold.
Oh, sorry, John Leonard. Wrong. Yeah. You're right. The beautiful. Yeah, John Arnold does not have a beautiful mind. John Leonard has the beautiful mind. John,
well, we love John Arnold too.
Well, John Arnold has beautiful hair.
How do you know?
And good videos. But John Arnold is John Leonard's the one with the crazy beautiful mind. Yeah, sorry about that, John.
No, I think it bodes well for this team that they were able to get this result tonight, largely without the four guys that you mentioned. And I think, especially given the McKennie news of earlier this week, I think that really bolsters Berhalter's message to the group. Mm-hmm. Like that the team does come first and there are standards and there are rules and there are going to be consequences if you don't follow them. And so it's going to be interesting to see how McKennie reacts, and especially, you know, what's going to happen at his club, because, you know, there have been rumblings going on for the last month and right before the end of the transfer window about how Max Allegri was, you know, unhappy with the way McKennie was handling himself in terms of his diet, in terms of his attitude, his desire to party, all of those things. And it's, you know, two different coaches have now, I mean, granted, before, I guess if you include Andrea Pirlo last year when he suspended McKennie for the party that was thrown, you've got three coaches now who are basically saying you got to get your act together. And, you know, if he doesn't do it now, maybe that, you know, we'll see if that light ever turns on for him.
All right. So, Jeff, since you brought it up, let's get into that. Since you were with the team and around the team during that whole episode in Nashville, is there any additional? I mean, you were the one that were reporting some stuff the other day that on top of all of the stuff in terms of breaking COVID rules, there's a whole hypocrisy part to this story that I think's interesting, too.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I was told that after the El Salvador game, McKennie was one of those saying, you know, hey, there has to be accountability. We have to take more responsibility. And then he turns around and engages in the behavior that got him sent home. And so, I mean, this is a guy that's on the leadership council that Berhalter formed. So it's going to be interesting to see what his status in the team is going to be. You know, is he a guy that's going to be able to speak up with any credibility? That's going to take some time to repair. And I mean, if I'm Weston McKennie and I get called into this next window, you know, I'm lying low for a little bit. You know, I'm going to be try to let my play and my behavior do most of the talking. And then again, try to build back his status within the team brick by brick. It's going to take a while. And we'll, you know, we'll see how it goes. But I mean, Berhalter has made it clear that this is not the end for Weston McKennie. And so I'm sure he's banking on the fact that the message is going to get received and he's going to react accordingly.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm really mad at Weston, like personally mad, because I've been such a huge supporter and hyped him up for so long, and he's from my town and he's from my club. I'm just really, really disappointed and mad in this, and I don't know what I want. I don't know. Am I wrong for being really mad at him, Andy? Are you mad at him too? I hope.
Yeah, I'm mad at him too, because I was right there with you, and you know, on the kick around, we've really praised him. And we've not just his play, but his leadership as well. We said we even said that he was the future captain.
Yeah.
That Christian, stand aside. McKennie is going to be the man.
Well, and he's such a good player and he does so many good things for the team, but to find out that this is kind of his personality mm-hmm. makeup is just so disappointing. I guess what I'm asking is I don't know if I want him to come back in the next window. I don't know if he needs to sit out for a while, or Buzz, do we want him to show back up on the 7th against Jamaica and throw out a baller?
The only way to know that is to be sort of much more intimate with him and his coaching staff and how he reacts. I can tell you that I have talked to people around FC Dallas a little bit mm-hmm. about this like, last day or two. And by all reports from people that knew him when he was coming through the academy, he was not like this, that he was incredibly responsible, that he often played up with older kids, that you could trust him implicitly. He was always on time and he was never late and he never broke any rules and he was a big leader and all that kind of stuff. So whatever has gone off the rails with him has only happened in the last probably couple of 2 or 3 years even. So if he can rebound quickly and show some contrition and show the right mentality with his coaching staff, they're the only ones that can decide that. His coaching staff is a pro and is an international with Berhalter. He'll have to make some sort of gesture. Like the team already said, I think they talked to that a little bit, but he'll need to do something. And if he can do enough and prove enough in a short time frame, then I don't think the time frame matters as long as the gesture is right.
Well, I know what it is, Buzz. It's moving to Milan, Italy.
I mean, maybe, but maybe it could have been. But certainly could have been. It
Turin,
also could have
Turin.
Been.
Oh, Turin. Yes, I'm Turin, sorry. Yeah. Turin. Well, same thing. All right, Turin, Italy. Not same thing, but the same point. Point made is that moving to Turin, Italy, at the age of 22 and playing for Juventus, it would probably be a difficult life change for any kid, especially after leaving Germany. So. And then, you know, Frisco before that. So, man, good Lord. Well, I hope he gets his head right with Ball, definitely. Jeff, do you, you know, moving forward, will you be able to travel? Are you traveling or doing any traveling with the team in the next window?
I expect to. It's just these triple fixture windows are a killer.
Yeah.
Just in terms
for
of the
everybody,
amount of time.
Right?
Yeah, for the amount of time that they kind of get sucked up. So, but I'll be at minimum for you know, at least two of the games the next window. So that will probably include the Panama game that's away.
Yeah, so the next three games for the U.S. is home against Jamaica on the 7th, and then Panama on the 10th, in Panama on the 10th. And where will they play in Panama, Andy? Do you know?
Yeah, it'll be Estadio Romel, the same stadium where they play all their national team games in Panama City.
Okay. And then
the famous site of the 3-2 turnaround win
when
they eliminated Panama from the World Cup back in 2013, leading up to the 2014 World Cup. Remember that game?
Yes.
The Zusi goal?
The Zusi goal. Yeah, the game that they didn't want to win.
Exactly.
Because that would have
Yeah, they helped Mexico
out
in the process too, right?
Yeah, Mexico never did us any favors.
That was, by the way, just let me throw that out there. That was when Zusi scored that goal. I was match commissioner that game. That was the quietest I had ever heard a home crowd in any stadium ever after another
really?
Team scored a goal. You could hear a pin drop
I forgot,
when Zusi scored that goal.
I forgot you were the match commissioner for that game. Yeah, that would have been quite a moment. And then the third game of the window is against Costa Rica here in the United States. So why that's interesting to me is now, instead of playing two games on the road in the window, the U.S. does get two home games. Canada, on the other hand, has to go to Mexico, who's ahead of us. Then they got to go to Jamaica before finishing out their window at home against Panama. Mexico has Canada, and then they have another home game against Honduras, and they finish out on the road in El Salvador. So probably there's an opportunity for the United States, probably not to catch Mexico, but certainly get ahead of Canada in this next window. That's a favorable window for the United States. Buzz, who do you think at this point, after watching these three games, who do you think most likely is the starting 11 for this team?
Oh, I mean, by mid-October, that's enough time that a lot can have changed. It really is impossible to predict that, you know. You have basically over a month, you know, mm-hmm. and it's going to depend on health. You know, I mean, like, would you think, like, if Gio Reyna's healthy, is he going to be in there? Of course, you know, Pulisic, of course. I mean, it's like.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I mean, I would not start Brooks.
Yeah,
I have
I'll
a question,
tell you that.
Buzz.
Yeah.
I want Buzz's opinion on this.
All right.
Has Pepe earned this? Is he the starter now with the 9?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Right?
Why wouldn't he be? I mean,
so
certainly
because,
the next one, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, we had talked about the 9 being the big issue with this team, right? The finding a striker. and that how that was going to get complicated, how it was going to make qualifying a complicated issue.
Yeah,
man, I don't know now. I think one game is too early, right? Yes. Okay, Sorry, I'm getting a little too excited.
Well, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. There was a moment in time when we were when the team was still behind 1-0, and I was thinking to myself, both my club team that I support and my national team are counting on an 18-year-old kid to score goals for them. And while that's cool that it's an 18-year-old kid, it's also not cool that it's an 18-year-old kid. But maybe I should just get over the fact that he's 18, and maybe he really is just that good.
Well, he certainly I would start him. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Jeff?
I said I would start him. I mean, you've got to go with guys who are doing the business on the field, who are proving themselves. And that cuts both ways. I mean, you know, Andy mentioned he wouldn't start John Brooks. What's interesting to me about John Brooks is, having watched him over the years, he does not travel well, especially when it's a short window. I mean, you look at his worst performances with the national team. They've tended to come during quick windows with a short turnaround between games. When he's performed at his best, it's tended to be before big tournaments where there was a long lead-up time for him to kind of get the jet lag out of his system, you know, get acclimated. You know, the one exception to that, I'm trying to remember, was the Nations League. But even that, I mean, they had a camp prior to that. So, you know, I think John Brooks may very well have played himself out of being at least a starter in this next window. Now, who do you? I mean, I will also add that I thought Mark McKenzie very quietly had a very solid game tonight.
Agreed.
You almost didn't notice him, but he was, and he didn't try to be flashy. He didn't try to like hit killer passes, but he played the game he was in. And I give kudos to Miles Robinson as well. And I think Berhalter could do a lot worse than to go back to those two guys. You know, Tim Ream did well also. So, I mean, he's got some options, but it's just interesting. They're not the options that you would have picked at the start of this window.
Andy, who was Berhalter's best player in these three games?
Well, Buzz is not going to like this. Adams has to be mentioned, but I think Robinson.
Interesting. Buzz, who did you think the best player in the three games was?
Robinson also. But I didn't think Adams was terrible. I just thought that on the middle game.
You poo-pooed on Adams last game. I will never forget that.
In the middle game, I thought he was just average. I wanted more from him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But over the three games, the center back, Robinson.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, Adams, for sure.
Yeah. What about you, Jeff?
I would put in a shout for the other Robinson. And I agree to an extent that because Miles Robinson played the most over these three games and barely put a foot wrong, he was probably the best player. But maybe the biggest stock up was Anthony Robinson, because – you know, heading into this, it was like, well, we have to play Serginho Dest on the left because there's nobody else. Well, lo and behold, there is somebody else. I mean, Anthony Robinson puts in, you know, a great assist against Canada, you know, for Brendan Aaronson's goal. He scores against Honduras. Killer goal celebration.
Don't break yourself.
I think he probably is the biggest stock up coming out of this window. You know, I think Aaronson proved himself quite a bit as well. And I think Christian Roldan has helped himself just in that super sub role. He's found a role for himself in this team, which is more than I could say for him prior to this window.
All right. I'll go Buzz. Who had the most disappointing three games? Who's been the one you were most disappointed in?
Disappointing three. Oh, well, Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, even in the game, the middle game, I thought, man, good Lord, this looks like a guy. I mean, I know this is not the case, but it looks like a guy who's trying to lose. I'm sure he wasn't, but that's what I was watching. I was like, there's no way this is the same player that I'm used to seeing. So that was the
You know, Jeff's comment about how he doesn't travel well. There were moments today, like on the goal, the first goal, when he misses that tackle. He runs out so fast, and then he misses the tackle, and he makes no effort to come back. And then a few minutes later, like the just even on a goal kick, you know, because they were trying to play out of the back, he actually initiates the goal kick, and his kick over to Turner is just so slow and half-assed. There's no sharpness or pace to it, and that was when I was like ready for them to take him out. I was so glad that he took him out at halftime. Andy or Jeff, who's next? Who's wanted to? I guess, well, Andy. Who is your?
I'm gonna
least
agree with
player?
Jeff, because I bet Jeff is gonna say Sargent.
Yep,
and I would agree with Jeff and say Sargent as well, with a nod to Sergino Dest.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, who are you gonna say, Jeff?
Yeah, I was gonna go with Sargent, just because, I mean, it seems like, and I say we, I think people are perpetually making excuses for this guy over the fact that he doesn't score. And it's like, well, he does all these other little things well. And, you know, it's been tough to tell at times at his club, because, you know, Bremen has not been very good and has not scored a lot of goals as a team. And so, you know, you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I just think that in these games, he just hasn't been goal dangerous. I mean, and the chances he does get, he never seems to make real solid contact with the ball. And yeah, I think what's going to be interesting is when Giassi Zardes gets fully healthy again, and if you have Ricardo Pepi, you know, what does Berhalter do? Does he still call Josh Sargent in? Probably, but he's fallen down on the pecking order for sure. I will give Dest a little bit. I will cut him a little bit of slack, because I thought against Canada there were times where he beat guys off the dribble and was able to advance the ball forward. And that was something that the U.S. was really missing, especially without Gio Reyna. You know, or even like an Eric Williamson, who unfortunately is injured and isn't going to play any more part in this cycle, I don't think. Mm-hmm. You know, just that ability to carry the ball. And I think that it put a little bit of pressure on Alphonso Davies in that game to like, well, I can't just ignore this, but yeah, I don't think, I think with the improvement of Anthony Robinson, you know, I think if Dest is going to play, it's got to be on the right, and you know, that's where he's going to be more comfortable, and I think that's what Berhalter should try to do. But you know, Yedlin certainly came on tonight and did some good work, especially that cross on Pepe's goal.
It all did work out. All right, Buzz, any final thoughts after U.S. 4, Honduras 1 on the road?
Yeah. I think sometimes we get caught up in these ideas about how young, you know, a team is, and everyone wants to trumpet that around. And we've done that ourselves with FC Dallas, you know, with how young they've been the last couple of years. And I always kind of come back to what my friend, the late Mike Renshaw, used to say, which was, soccer's a young man's game, and if they're good enough, they're old enough, it doesn't matter. And I'm sure there are many other people that have been quoted saying the same sort of things. And you look at this team, and everyone talks about how young it is, but I see guys that are playing at the highest level of the game around the world. I see guys that have international experience now, and they're all young, and that's awesome. I think that's a fantastic place to be, given where we were a few years back, and given where we were going into, not this Gold Cup, but the one a year ago, when they brought in still Altidore and guys of that older group. And I, for one, blasted them for not already starting the youth revolution and just all in on, they left out Sargent, for example, at the time. And I said, man, if he's your guy of the future, why are we leaving him out and bringing in a 30-something-year-old striker? I mean, who cares if you win or lose the Gold Cup? So I'm glad that we finally got there, and that we're actually embracing this young group, because this is how great teams finally win stuff. Not that we're ready to win stuff, but this is how you do it, is you go with all these young guys and you build them up and you play them through a couple of cycles and you see what happens.
Andy, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Buzz 100%. I really am for playing the young players. You just play them in the right spots, I think, is important. Don't overcomplicate things. But I don't mind seeing the young players, inexperienced players, get minutes in these kind of games. And the other thing I want to say is, remember that the start of this qualifying tournament, the octagonal, we thought these three games were not a good setup and not a good way to start the tournament for the U.S. in terms of who they were going to play away and home. The next window is a little bit easier in that regard. So I think we're going to be expecting a little bit more point-wise. I'm happy with the 5 points, but I think the next window we should be expecting 7, maybe 9. I don't think that's too far-fetched to want the team to get those amount of points the next three games.
As a Canadian, here, I got a question there for you, Andy. Are you more excited and pleased about your 5 points as a Canadian versus the 5 points the United States got?
In terms of pleased and excited, I have to say Canada, because it was unexpected for me. Although Buzz clearly knew they were going to be doing this. I didn't. He's probably following the team a little bit better than I am, unfortunately. But the U.S., I expected at least 5 points at this stage. And so I think the U.S. is in a good, comfortable spot heading into this next window, which I think is going to be the easier window of the ones then coming up, because then they get Mexico and then it gets really tough. So I have to say I'm okay with the U.S. where they are. I'm really pleased that Canada is at 5 points.
Well, I never am ceased to be amused and amazed at how the collective attitude can change, because winning is so much fun. And getting the win, it changes everything. Everything feels like it's going to be okay at this point. And now I have a debt to pay off, because prior to the game, I did offer on Twitter that if the U.S. was to leave this game with 3 points, I would buy a pair of those awful, terrible, heinous new socks the U.S. was wearing, and I will wear them. I will mall walk in them with a pair of khaki shorts and a white T-shirt around North Park. So I will do that. That's my bet to pay off with the United States win. And we'll figure out when I'll do that. And we'll take photos and videos for everybody as well. Jeff Carlisle from ESPN, thanks so much for joining us tonight, man. It's always awesome to talk to you and get your insight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Buzz, you are the man. You are the original. The nickname is yours. Nothing out of all of this makes me more happy than to see a nickname that you gave Ricardo Pepi. You started it. Now is being tweeted by everybody around the world. That is super kick-ass.
Yeah, it's pretty fun, isn't it?
It's more than fun.
It's pretty fun.
It's pretty fun. Yeah.
You need to be invited by Pepi wherever he's playing, like for AC Milan or wherever the hell he ends up.
Yeah. Well,
you need to get a special invite to go watch from the VIP box.
I mean, if he hadn't liked it, it would have been squashed right away and the media guys wouldn't have run with it. But, the fact that he liked it is what made it work.
Jeff,
Jeff,
are you even aware of the fact that Buzz is the one that gave him the nickname?
No.
Yeah, Buzz started that nickname, El Train, and the whole train thing. How long ago, Buzz?
It was during the hat trick debut for North Texas in 2019. And when he scored, first or second goal, maybe, I tweeted something like, "Welcome aboard the Ricardo Pepi hype train, choo-choo." And then shortly after that, I Googled, I was in the press box at Globe Life over there, and I Googled what train was in Spanish. And when I saw it was El Tren, I thought, oh, crap, that's perfect. And so then I started using El Tren for his nickname, and I went home and I made that T-shirt that we started selling right away. And so anytime he ever did anything, I was doing choo-choo and putting train things out and all aboard, and it caught on. And then somebody asked him if he liked it. He said he really did. And there's a whole bunch of backstory about why I thought that name fit him, which we could talk about some other time. And but in the end, that's why it took off. It's because he embraced it, and then the social media guys embraced it, and it's run off and got a life of its own. And it's a lot of fun to see it happening and see it go, in a sense, go viral with his success.
Well, everybody should go buy an L Train shirt from Buzz's website, thirddegree.net, because they're awesome. And now they'll be super in fashion.
Yeah, I got to make one with a 14 on it now for the U.S.
Hey, Buzz, you know that there's some fan base in Europe, some random team, a good team in Europe, whose fan base is going to start buying your t-shirts once he transfers.
Yeah, you're going to make a lot of money, bud.
You are. You're going to be rich.
So rich. We're gonna
if only I had a royalty. Yeah. Wait till he puts it on a jersey, then it'll be really hype.
Right, exactly. All right, guys. Thanks so much, Andy. We will be back live Saturday, 2 p.m. on The Ticket. Jeff and Buzz, thank you so much. And thank you, P1s, for listening. We love and adore you. Go USA. Go on. Get out there. Get stuck in and win your 50s.